Blind Nil Audio.
Today on 50 Fires, I have a conversation with my friend Bryce Roberts. Bryce is a venture capitalist who has focused his career on investing in software companies. Bryce is also a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, often known as Mormons.
I feel like this is a booby trap.
There's such a deep tension here.
No matter what spiritual or religious background we come from, money causes an internal conflict.
It's deeply ingrained in our faith, a relationship and tension with money.
We're going to talk about it today on 50 Fires. I have a question for you. How much money do you have? And is it enough for you? I've started calling that the devil's golden question. And I believe I first heard a version of it in the 90s in a lecture given by a Latter-day Saint scholar named Hugh Nibley. And of course, Latter-day Saints are known more popularly as Mormons, and I happen to be one. And because I'm from that culture and also live in Utah, there's this super interesting undercurrent of pressure and stress around money that very few people seem to be willing to talk about out loud. So I can't tell you how refreshing it was to speak to my friend Bryce Roberts on today's episode. What's interesting about Bryce is that he's a venture capitalist, but he's also a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, just like me. And so Bryce and I go in a rather unexpected direction in this conversation. I didn't know if we would get to talk about the role that money has played in our faith tradition and how our culture of faith has impacted our relationship with money. But thankfully, we did. I'm Carl Richards, and we're talking about money with Bryce Roberts. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. Quick confession, I feel like I need to get this out of the way right up top here. It turns out no one taught me how to talk about money either. And it's been my job for 25 years. In fact, I'm a financial planner. And for 10 years, I wrote and illustrated a weekly column in the New York Times about money. One of my goals with each episode is to get deep quickly. And so it was such a pleasure and frankly an honor that Bryce would go there with me so that we could have this conversation about money and meaning in our lives. As I mentioned earlier, Bryce is a venture capitalist and has focused his career on investing in consumer and enterprise software companies. But long before Bryce was a friend, I was actually an admirer of his work, largely because he seemed to be doing something different. And while venture capitalists aren't known for a deep sense of introspection, and by the way, if you're a VC and you're yelling at me right now because you're known for that, please feel free to send me an email. But it turns out Bryce is known for that. So enjoy my conversation with Bryce Roberts. Bryce, we've never had this conversation. I'm super curious about what's the earliest memory you have of money?
There's probably two I can think of. But I probably became aware of money my sixth grade year. And I became aware of it because, like, that's the year it was clear my dad started making money. And, you know, I don't know if you ever had this experience either, but, like, you know, we were solidly, like, middle class. You know, he was, like, an attorney. He was a young family, just barely getting by. We were in Portland, Oregon is where I grew up. And, you know, we just lived, like, out in the burbs in this little ranch house on a totally forgettable street. And then in sixth grade, I got told that we were moving. And we were moving to kind of the fancy suburb of Portland. And not only were we moving to the fancy suburb of Portland, we were going to live on a lake. And my dad got a new Porsche. And we joined the country club that people wanted to be a member of. Like, suddenly,
wow.
I'd been wearing, like, Payless Shoe Source knockoffs of the shoes I actually wanted my whole life, right? And I remember the new Jordans coming out and being like, oh my gosh, those are like $100. Like, unheard of to have $100 tennis shoe. And like, I got it. Money was never something I thought that much about. And then suddenly it became something that was very present. And I became very aware of it.
You said solidly middle class. Like, how did you know you were solidly middle class before this sixth grade experience?
Because I would ask for the nice thing and I would get the middle of the road thing. You know, like you and I are roughly the same age, right? So, so an example of that would be for Christmas one year, I would ask for a Diamondback BMX bike.
Right? I had a Redline.
Yeah. So you had a Redline. And that was like Redline, Diamondback, like those were the bikes you really wanted, right?
Yeah.
What I got under the Christmas tree that year was a Huffy with a chocolate bar seat.
Dude, Huffy's so much better, though. It's so much better.
The story's so much better. But as a kid, it was just like, ooh.
How do you remember wanting? Like, I wanted the Diamondback, or I wanted
I was just Jordan. Always aware. And you know, I mean, when did your kind of awareness of brands or kind of the stratification of brands emerge?
Yeah, I can't. I went through a breakdancing phase.
Oh yeah, we all had it.
With the cardboard that we'd carry around and put down
for
on
sure.
there.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I remember wanting this specific kind of parachute pants.
Yeah.
And then like MC Hammers, I think, or something. And I also remember very specifically that we lived in a really nice neighborhood. Well, not far from you. Like we lived in Harvard, Yale, and we couldn't afford to live there. My parents were divorced and we moved into that house. And I think my mom probably spent everything she had to get us into that house. And I remember, the reason I remember knowing this is we drove a 2-door Mazda GLC, like white hatchback GLC for the family of four.
Wow.
And it was the only car. So when I turned 16, I used to take that car at night and like I would jump it and spin it and reverse emergency brake, you know, and just be so irresponsible. But I remember that like Mazda GLC was maybe the first time where I was like, oh, we're different than everybody else in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so fun to have this conversation because it's driven me nuts. Like cars are, you know, like I feel like the car I'm driving now, or at least the car my wife drives now, is just a giant iPad. You know, and if it stops working, it's over.
Right. I too have one of those iPad cars.
Yeah.
And you know, it kind of goes against every instinct that I have around ownership. You know, we have that car, which is great and new, and we have to reboot it all the time. And there have actually been times where it's literally like that. Analogy of it like driving an iPhone is very real because our car has actually bricked before where like you literally couldn't get in it, move it, do anything to it.
Oh.
And then the flip side of that, we have a car with 200,000 miles on it.
Yeah.
And we had to force ourselves because our tendency with cars is to just own them forever, run them into the ground. The last car we had, I literally just drove it to a shop and said, you know, just if you need it for parts, whatever, and then took an Uber home. So like, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's a very real thing too.
So good. I'd love to spend a little bit of time talking about what impact your religious or spiritual tradition has had on your feelings about money.
Oh, dude, come on. This is, you know, this is a massive can of worms.
This is exactly why I asked. So you and I are both Latter-day Saints that other people would maybe know more colloquially as Mormons. And there's definitely a thread of money that runs through that. And specifically, you know, both our religious tradition and also our cultural tradition here in Utah. So I'm just curious about what do you make of that? Like what sticks out to you?
I feel like this is a booby trap. Like this is.
It may, well, let me tell you, my editor at the New York Times used to always say, "You know what? I need more from you, Carl." I'm like, "What? More God? I need more God." And I was like, "What? What does that
here's
mean?"
Here's the thing, like, you know this. Like, there's such a deep tension here.
Yeah,
and there's so many layers that are cultural to our you know, kind of religious upbringing that I feel like would be lost on so many people, or it would come across as maybe even unsavory.
Let's talk about it.
It's deeply, deeply, deeply ingrained in our faith, a relationship and tension with money.
Yeah.
The early days of the church, how many times did the church teeter on bankruptcy? How much of a factor was money from the very beginning? And culturally, how much is righteousness tied to worldly financial blessings? And so I remember when I was just out of undergrad. It was kind of my first startup job. It was with a company, and they recruited this guy out of Southern California. He'd moved his whole family to Utah. He was like us. He was LDS. And this was kind of dot-com days. And he came in and he did a good job, but you know, ultimately they let him go as part of the kind of layoffs that were happening with the dot-com stuff. And I watched him for years kind of struggle to find his footing. And this was someone who was super accomplished. And I remember having the thought and then becoming aware of and chastising myself for having the thought, which was, what's he doing wrong? Like, there must be something wrong in his life. He must be off track. Because in my mind and the way that, you know, I had constructed my relationship with money, faith, and that whole kind of stew was that they were deeply intertwined. You know, how many times through the scriptures do you read, like, keep my commandments, have blessings? Almost like this vending machine of faith. I will put in a good act, and for that, I will get out. Like, it's a very transactional relationship. And I remember, just because that was the first time in my life, you know, at that point in my life, I had a kid, my wife, you know, we were having our second, so she wasn't working anymore. I was the sole provider for our family. I became very, very aware of, particularly at that point, money and being able to provide for a young family. And I was watching this person and thinking, like, oh, he must be doing something wrong. You know, because I know, you know, the formula is really simple. And then it was just like a ton of bricks was dropped on my head that I've basically spent the last 30 years of my life trying to unpack, process, and come to terms with. I would imagine you've maybe not had the exact experience, but you've felt that tension before.
Yeah. Well, this is just to widen the aperture a little bit. This is not just a problem with our faith tradition.
Sure.
This is generally this prosperity gospel challenge.
For sure. Yeah, you know, maybe it's pronounced everywhere else, but my lived experience is my only experience, right? And so I've seen other churches, I've seen other faith, but I know in our church, for instance, like, people who are financially successful tend to have a lot of leadership opportunities.
Yep.
They are put forward as examples often and elevated to positions of power very frequently, to the point where it's almost indistinguishable. Sometimes in some, you know, different congregations, you know, this kind of financial and social strata is very obvious.
Yeah, let's back. So you said like a ton of bricks, and I've been trying to unravel that for the last 30 years. Like, what are you pointing to specifically? This idea that you believed, or we seem to believe culturally, that there's a direct link between faith and religiosity and spirituality, maybe even, and material blessings?
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. So that's, you know, I would say that's what hit me as a ton of bricks was how naive that was and how wrong that was.
How much nuance it lacks and
completely, you know, and I think I remember in that moment having that thought and being immediately drawn forward to the story of Job in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Hey, everyone. In case you're not familiar with the biblical story of Job, or just need some context for what Bryce was pointing at, my version of it is that here's a guy, Job, who seemed to do everything right, and things still didn't work out for him. And I think the point Bryce was trying to make is that it's so interesting that we often make a connection between performative faith, you know, our spirituality, and material blessings. Anyway, back to my conversation with Bryce.
But it's very similar. Like, let's just, I would be curious what your reaction is to, you spend a lot of time in VC land,
yep,
and startup land, and there's a different set of religious beliefs there. Like, I don't mean like religious beliefs. There's a religion around. There's
definitely a religion.
And how do you see, compare, contrast the behavior, the feeling about the car, which sports team do you own, or which newspaper do you own? Like, how do you see that playing out? Now, I'm not letting you off the hook, by the way. I want to come back to the...
No. I just want to make sure I understand the question, because where my mind goes immediately is the base level of worship or faith is emulation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, faith is a belief in something that you can't see, touch, feel, but you want to live in a way that delivers on the promise of that faith. And so you look for a playbook, and you and I were born into, have chosen to stay aligned with a very certain playbook. And there are specific rules that go with that playbook. Pulling that forward into startups, it's exactly the same thing, right? Like, it's just it's a different set of playbooks for a different set of rewards, but ultimately the faith is not in a higher power. It's in like this ability to actualize this end result you see in your mind, you feel in your mind, you feel in your heart at whatever scale it is you're trying to achieve. And so I think there is religion and then there's cults, right? Like, there's, and I would say in many respects, the startup world has largely kind of consolidated into more of a cult than a religion.
We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talkin' Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talkin' Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talkin' Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Welcome back to 50 Fires.
in many respects, the startup world has largely kind of consolidated into more of a cult than a religion. It's incredibly dogmatic. It's incredibly unquestioned, even though it doesn't have, in many cases, you know, a cult has a figurehead at the front of it. You know, there's kind of like a trinity of figureheads as it relates to, you know, a startup cult, which is, you know, we, you know, maybe it's Elon Musk today, right? Like there's something, someone they're aspiring to be. And as a result, there's, you know, entire industries built around unpacking what that playbook is, mm-hmm. what the steps it takes to achieve it.
The tactics and the steps.
Yeah. But if you think about it in the context of faith, like what's the highest level of living your faith? Right? It's actually living it out of love. It's not living it out of fear. It's not trying to copy anybody else. It's like the pure, you know, I mean, charity. It's living with the purest form of love for what it is you are either worshiping, servicing, trying to attain. And I think, you know, we've talked about this a little bit too. Like at the commandment-y level, religion is really, especially Mormons, everybody else, like religion can be really complex and feel incredibly constricting. Whereas at the highest level, it's so much easier.
It's just love God and love your neighbor.
Yeah, it really is that simple. Everything else is in service of that. And I think in the case of startups, just like in religion, the playbooks are all good. It's all designed to pull you forward to that highest level. The tension I feel in startups is most people never get past understanding and playing by the rules. And I think that's why entrepreneurs who, you know, like Yvonne Chouinard at Patagonia, he resonates so deeply as an entrepreneur, not just as a brand, but as an entrepreneur with people. Because he understood the rules, and then he broke almost all of them.
Real quick, what Bryce just said about Yvonne Chouinard resonating so deeply because he understood the rules and then broke most of them, I'm not entirely sure I agree with the idea that Chouinard understood the rules. I think one of the reasons Yvonne Chouinard resonates so deeply is because he just didn't care, right? He broke all the rules because he just didn't care. He saw a need in the world for something that he cared deeply about, and he made it. And that's led to all sorts of interesting examples, like deciding that they were going to move all their production away from organic cotton. And more recently, structuring ownership of Patagonia in a way that will allow he and his family to give to the causes that they care deeply about.
To say, okay, I understand the rules, but now I have to, this is such a personal journey. You know, and I we've talked about this a little bit. Entrepreneurship is such a personal journey. It's such a, you know, and I've watched you wrestle with this in your business and trying to find ways to actualize in your work the things that you value and the things that you believe you uniquely bring to the world and the messages you feel like you need to put out there and the products you need to put out there. And I think a lot of people get trapped in playing by the rules. And so you end up with these like monocultures. Just like, you know, I mean, I think that's, you grew up in Utah. I didn't grow up in Utah, but I would imagine Salt Lake City in the 80s and 90s particularly felt acutely like a monoculture. No?
Yeah, no, exactly. And it still largely does. I mean, it's getting better, right? But what's so interesting about both of those sets of faith, right, is that we lose the plot so quickly. So, you know, like we know clearly that when you know, on your deathbed, we know that the things that you'll regret are the missed opportunities with people that you love, right? Like experiences, like the things you didn't do. You're not going to regret things you tried and failed. You're going to regret the things you didn't do.
That you knew and you felt compelled to do and ignored.
Yeah. And we also know that the greatest source of happiness is experiences with people you love. Like that's the greatest, we know that, like that's settled doctrine anywhere. And then we hold up, which is what I was super curious to just talk to you about, is often we hold up people who have been successful financially, but we're all pretty aware because of public behavior that they're not the kind of person you want to be, right? And we don't need to get specific, but we see that all the time.
All the time.
Right? And in fact, some of the most famous cases, I think we all know well, there's TVs and books written about people that are not fantastic people. You wouldn't want them as your friend, but we all emulate them because they were successful, and largely they were successful financially.
That's right.
How do you get yourself, because I think that's, we're having that in both cases, like culturally, from a faith background, the work that we do, the people we hang out with, the private equity crew, the venture capital crew, entrepreneurship crew, like at church, how do you get clear about the plot? And then how do you have the strength, not the strength, but the courage really to swim in the, against that stream?
Probably a few different dimensions we could tackle that from, right? I think part of the issue is what circles you run in and what things those circles value. When you are running with the mainstream venture-backed startup crowd, the leaderboard is pretty clear, right? Valuation, how much you've raised. To be in that, you either play by those rules and adopt those values, or you have to opt out. And I think you and I have talked a lot about this because I played by those rules for a long time, and I'd done well personally by playing those rules. But I also saw the tension that it creates in so many people in recognizing like that's actually not motivating to them. Or that's not how they think about the world, the business they're building, the impact they want to have. You know, there's a term I hear related to Utah, but I'm sure it relates everywhere else, this kind of idea of keeping up with the Joneses, right? And so the neighborhood you're in, the community you're in, you become who you hang around. You adopt those sets of values. I think the real opportunity isn't to try to change those sets of values in those given communities and ecosystems. It's to create new communities and ecosystems, right? And so I could have spent the remainder of my career trying to change the way venture capital thinks about building and scaling businesses and supporting entrepreneurs. Or I can opt out and say, let's collectively try to create a new ecosystem or a different adjacent ecosystem, and let's tweak some of the values. Let's talk about the things that we don't talk about in that other ecosystem. Let's value maybe some of the things we don't value in that other ecosystem. And I think you and I live in Utah. You go up to Little Cottonwood Canyon, to Alta on any given day, and there's an ecosystem up there that has a very, very different set of values than what the circles you and I run in professionally. I remember being on a lift, this is probably 15 years ago now, with a guy, middle of the day on like a Wednesday. Amazing powder day. And we were just chatting. What do you do? Oh, I basically don't work. Huh, you're like my age. What's the deal? I have a website called dogpoopsacks.com.
Right?
Dogpoopsacks.com makes this guy $250,000 a year. And for him,
what else do you need?
That's all he needs to live the lifestyle he wants to have. For me, I'm like $250,000 a year. Like, what are we talking about? You know, the circles that I run in, that's like a rounding error to the kind of ambition most people would have for their business, right? And yet for him, the circles he runs in, the community he's with, that's enough. And you tell me, how often in your business, in your financial advising world and your friendship circles, like how often do people even use that word enough? And you, last time we talked, presented me with what you call the devil's golden question.
Yeah. For a little bit of context, there's a cultural sort of teaching that we have that you know, the devil, however you want to refer to the devil, asked this question of us. In modern culture, probably ancient culture too, like as long as it's been going on. And the reason I care so much about this question is it's really pointing to maybe a central tension of the way we live our lives, which is the crux of the decision around living a life of contentment and happiness, independent of what it says about the next life, like whether you believe in that or not. I like living a life of contentment and happiness versus a life of constant attachment, constant grasping, constant like trying to get more and more and more. Maybe the tension between enough and needing more. The question is, how do you interact with money? Like, Do you have any money? How much money do you have? And the answer is, you know, there's only really one answer, and the answer is enough. You know, I have sufficient. I have enough. And figuring out how you individually answer that question, and this is me just sort of cobbling together pieces of threads of ancient and timeless wisdom and the teachings of, you know, super smart people here now, is like, look, the crux of our, I happen to believe, that's why I'm so committed to this work, like this conversation and the work that I'm doing, is that the crux of our, I would go so far as to say like happiness, the crux of our contentment in life is, how do you answer the question? Like, do you have enough or do you need more? Like, and the golden question may just be like, how much money do you have?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, isn't there, there's like a Ryan Halliday book about, I mean, maybe, you know, he did that whole series, but there was one line in there that I reflect back on a lot. And I don't remember which of those books it was, but it was basically like, if the question is how much, the answer will always be more.
How do you think about enough?
I don't think about it, which is wrong, because my default today is like more. And yet you hit on it earlier, right? We talked about like deathbed regrets. No one regretted not having more money. And I think this goes back to that a bit, that kind of devil's golden question. You know, the way you framed it, I just loved it, which is, you know, part of that question is like, or the assertion in there as part of the question is like, anything you want, you can buy. Anything you're missing, any hole you feel, any trouble you're having, any conflict you're feeling, it can be resolved with money.
Yeah.
And yet when you put forward that idea of end of life scenarios, thinking about like, the experiences that build a life and the experiences that detract from a life are the experiences. They're the relationships. And you tell me, I think that's ultimately the devil's golden lie, right? Like, he's trying to convince you that you can buy anything, when in reality, the most important things, the things that at the end of life you're going to value and cherish the most, you literally cannot buy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, money can enhance, and, you know, I mean, you and I both, like, money allows us to go ski with our families. Money allows us to buy the gear to do things. Money allows us to travel. Money allows us to have a life and lifestyle that contributes to that. But ultimately, if we didn't have the money, the reality is there are people who live on far, far less than you and I, who are living incredibly full lives because they get it. They know that the stuff that matters is actually the stuff without a price tag. And I think to pull forward maybe your term from earlier, like crafting relationships. You know what I mean?
Like intentionally. Like,
intentionally, daily craft work on shaping these relationships we have in our lives with our friends, family, whomever. Like, how, you know, what an incredible gift to recognize that, and what an insane amount of tension that brings into all of our lives, because it doesn't make sense. Like, you can't resolve it.
Yeah, I read some, and I can't remember who said it, but it was one of these timeless wisdoms, sort of I honestly can't even remember what spiritual or religious tradition it was from, but it was like it's talking about this same crux problem, and said something like, "Take anything you want," like the other thing, the devil, like painting the devil as the opposition was, take anything you want and leave the change.
Mm.
In fact, the claim was, if you can buy it with money, if you actually can buy it with money, it's going to be fleeting. And I'm not sure about the boundary condition of that statement, but I do know that it does point in the right direction, which is, it's all the things. Like, if you hadn't grown up where skiing and the gear to do it was important, it turns out, and there's great research around this, and it almost, I mean, it makes me emotional to think about. Like, it turns out a walk every evening with my wife would generate the same, maybe more, lasting contentment and happiness than skiing, right? It's not about skiing. It's not about France. It's not about New Zealand. It's literally like, did I wake up and the first thing I did was go find my daughter and give her a hug, right? Like that's and you can't, like, there's no buying. And I like this intentional craftsmanship. One phrase I've been a big fan of, and we think a lot about, and we're really trying to like actualize, is emotional patina.
Yeah.
The idea of like my vision of it is a fire pit in the backyard that's built from stone, you know, like there's stone seats. And the idea of like having 50 fires in a year, and that 50 different people sat, and that stone, that place starts to embody this emotional relationship patina that's just rich and deep. And you can feel it. Like, you can feel it when you're in an old pub in Ireland, right? You can feel those sorts of places. So I think that's super interesting.
Well, I love that. And, you know, my wife and I just celebrated our 27th anniversary, and it's like that patina, which is it's just such a beautiful word, because, you know, as we've aged together, we were joking earlier about the wrinkles, right? And we were joking, you know, like when I look at my wife now, there's probably some version of a person who would look at their wife after 27 years and be like, oh, I need somebody younger. I need somebody, blah, blah, blah. I look at it, I'm like, I see the wrinkles. I see, for her, I just see everything through the lens of things that other people might see as faults, to see it as like, wow, we've built this together. Even the imperfections in our own bodies, we've built this together. And to be able to lean into that worn in comfort versus feeling like you need something different or more is really, really safe and comforting place to be. And, you know, I look at this conversation alone, I see you living that same reality. You didn't choke up when we talked about ski gear or, you know, adventures. But when you talk about that investment in and crafting of that relationship with your wife, that's when the emotion comes, because you know,
yeah,
in the middle of all this stuff, that's the thing that matters the most. And that's the thing that it costs zero to say, let's get out tonight and go for a walk, or to have that just be part of the routine. And that's where it's so easy to lose that, unfortunately, in the rush of constantly building and constantly answering that question of, you know, with answering the question of more, you know, with the answer of more.
Oh, so Bryce, so much more to say, but I feel like I just want to let that hang.
Dude, I feel like there's a million things we haven't even touched on, because we didn't even talk about, you know, the last text you and I exchanged was around Jesus giving his money to the thief, letting him manage it. And
so let me just real quickly, before have a pin right there. Don't forget what you're going to say, because let me just give people context. There's this crazy verse, and I can't right now recall exactly where it is. I think it's in Matthew, where Jesus, there's this setting, if you can imagine, they're in the house, and Jesus and two or three of his disciples are together in a house. Word gets out that he's there. Mary of Bethany shows up. Mary of Bethany's carrying an alabaster box, which apparently tradition has it that that's like alabaster was, the alabaster box was where you kept your most prized possessions. This is like the safe of the old days, right? Mm. Like, and Mary shows up with this alabaster box, and in it she has this ointment and perfume, and she, you know, uses the oil and the perfume on Jesus. So this is like her making like this beautiful offering, and the disciples are a little bit upset, and one particular is upset, and he says something like, oh, this is such a waste. We could have sold that stuff and given the money to the poor. Why would it be such a waste? And there's all sorts of beautiful lessons about that, but the thing I'd never noticed was the narrator, who, as I recall, this is in Matthew. Matthew chimes in right here and says, he wasn't upset because he cares about the poor. He's upset because he's a thief and he was the one in charge of the bag. And I was like, what? So what I told Bryce was, this conversation we had was like, why was Jesus in a position where he put a thief as his CFO or as his accountant? Now, we don't know. And in my head, we have two choices. One is he just didn't know. He didn't think about it. The thing I choose to believe out of this story is that there was another decision. So now, that with that context, what were you going to say?
Since that conversation, I think maybe even later that week, SVB happened.
Mm. So Silicon Valley Bank and the failure there.
And I had a lot of money. We were in the middle of this remodel, so I just moved a bunch of money into my SVB account for Anna Marie to be able to pay all the contractors and do all the things without having to think too much about it. And in the context of that conversation, I had to sit for an entire weekend with the idea that in the grand scheme of things, you know, it wasn't like we would be ruined if that would have gone away. We have money at, you know, fancy banks elsewhere that, you know, manage other money for us. But it definitely shined a spotlight on a relationship with money with enough zeros behind it that you really had to sit with it and sit with your relationship with money. And there were times throughout that weekend where it looked like a lot of that money was going to vaporize. And I think the seeds of that conversation we had related to Christ and his choice of CFO and potentially what that said about his relationship to money or how we should have the relationship we should have with money was a real, you know, it was just a touchstone for me through the weekend as I was wrestling with the, you know, trying to help our companies, trying to deal with it personally. It ended up being just an incredibly valuable touchstone for me and a very real check-in about my own relationship with this stuff.
My conclusion, the conclusion I choose to believe, which I have no basis for, right? Other than everything else Jesus said. Other than everything else he said, I have no basis for it. Which is like the reason the thief was put in charge of the money was just to continue to prove the point. Like, look, this does not matter. What matters is love. Like, it matters so little. Watch this.
Yes.
I'm gonna put a thief in charge. Right. And then that weekend, Silicon Valley Bank, like we had just finished raising our A round, really our seed plus round or whatever we call it these days. And it was all at SVB and we all sat around doing the same thing. Sort of like, what does this mean? And so, yeah, I think those moments we get a chance to really, gosh, to really think about like what all the wisdom traditions teach. And particularly in light of this conversation, what Jesus Christ taught about money over and over and over was it does not matter. What matters is love. You know, so we got time for one more question. I want you to pretend like it's 25 years from now and I am still doing this show. And I invite your youngest daughter, Ruby, you know, 25 years from now, she'll be 37. She's 12. And you're listening to the show afterwards. What do you hope you hear Ruby say about money?
Oh, man, about money.
Yeah, what do you hope you hear Ruby say about her relationship with money?
I hope Ruby would talk about money as a bit player, not the main character. And that, you know, the life that she was living, the life she constructed, the relationship she had would be the star of the show. And that it was simply money in her mind was an outcome to all of the other things that she was enjoying in her life and the impact that she was having in her life. That would be, you know, I think that for me has been a guiding principle in a lot of respects, even though I am acutely aware of money at the highest level, I can't tell you how much is in my checking account. And I think that's a real luxury. But I think it's also the result of a life lived not focusing on money, which seems strange for an investor to say. But I would hope it served me really well. I'm really pleased with the life that I'm in the middle of making. And I hope that my kids can pick up on that and internalize that in their own families.
Amen, Bryce.
All right, dude.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for pushing me on this stuff. This isn't stuff I think about that often. So I always love when we get a chance to talk about it because it's, you know, I think the hard part is you know, or the value of these conversations is you make explicit what's kind of running in the background. Mm. And I know it's consuming cycles and I know it's burning up energy emotionally, mentally. And so making it explicit is actually incredibly valuable. So for me and everybody else that I'm sure tunes in and follows along, you're doing an incredible service in pulling forward the stuff that's probably weighing on us and consuming more cycles than we even realize. So thank you.
Thank you. Look, I don't know if this resonates as deeply with everybody else as it does with me, but I have a suspicion that it does because I've had thousands of these conversations over the years. They're just not recorded. And what comes up for me is this idea that money brings with it a whole set of unexamined beliefs, beliefs that guide us whether we know it or not, beliefs that cause us to slip into patterns full of judgment, of shame, and blame. Beliefs that push us to act in ways we don't understand or even acknowledge, because I would imagine that as you listen to this conversation, you were recalling experiences you had with money, maybe as far back as when you were 12, just like Bryce, or maybe even earlier. Almost all of us were taught to never talk about money, politics, sex, or religion. And that causes so much tension and anxiety that the only way we can work past it is to turn around and look it in the eye. Pick up these unexamined beliefs and have the uncomfortable conversation. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks for joining me today. And I look forward to talking a lot more with you in the future. Until next time. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio. If you find this show valuable, would you do me a favor? Share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 star review on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to larger audiences. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you around the fire for our next episode.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.